This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from two experts concerned about what happens next with the 2020 U.S. Census.
We're talking about billions and billions of dollars of economic revenue that's based on census data. That data will be tainted, distorted for a decade.
And we'll explore ways that the Guadalupe Napomo Dune Center covers the extensive history of the dunes.
This last excavation, we found the head of a sphinx. It's gargantuan. It's about 300 pounds.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 19th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Today is California's online voter registration deadline. Capital Public Radio's Chris Nichols has some details on what that means.
Californians have a lot of options for how to register to vote ahead of Election Day, but you'll lose one of those at midnight. Which is
the registration deadline if you're going to register online in time to get a ballot still sent to you in the mail.
That's Sacramento County Elections spokesperson Jana Haynes. The deadline applies to voters in every county. You can go to registertovote.ca.gov or search for it on the Secretary of State's website. Even if you miss today's deadline, you still have more chances.
We now have voter registration in person that can happen all the way up through Election Day on November 3rd.
You can sign up at your county elections office, or later this week, you can register at the first vote centers to open in 15 counties. Finally, you can do what's called same-day voter registration on Election Day at any polling location.
In Sacramento, I'm Chris Nichols.
California's 24th congressional district race features an incumbent Democrat who has emphasized sustainability and preservation of the Central Coast during his tenure. His Republican opponent is an outspoken radio host and columnist who's been commenting on local politics since the 1990s. Sean Flannelly reports.
J. Andrew Caldwell hosts the Andy Caldwell Show every weekday, which airs on a few local AM talk radio stations. He brings on guests to talk about their recently published work, as well as comment on national and local news. The radio host also runs Santa Barbara's Collab, or the Coalition of Labor, Agriculture, and Business, aimed at promoting the common business interests of its members. He's been the executive director of Collab since 1991. Caldwell was formerly a columnist at the Santa Maria Times for 17 years. He's now published three times a week in the Santa Barbara News Press. Caldwell lives with his family in Napomo. He says he never planned to go into politics himself, but was encouraged to do it by friends and family.
I've been a government watchdog for the last 30 years, and I've been painfully aware of how I believe our government is failing us.
Caldwell also cited his concerns about recent protests and social unrest in San Luis Obispo as a motivation for his campaign.
One of the most bucolic towns in all of America. These people shut down our freeway twice, and they tried to do it a third time. Now, I don't deny that people have griefs, but I want to work on the problem, not create more problems vis-a-vis the protests.
Caldwell says his other top priorities include improved forest management for wildfire prevention and keeping the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant open. The California Public Utilities Commission signed off on the closure of Diablo Canyon in 2018. And the plant is set to start closing in 2024. The Republican candidate says keeping the plant open is critical to the economy and the state's power grid. Caldwell says he learned early on in life that manufacturing and industrial jobs were key to a healthy economy, and he wants to take care of the workers along the Central Coast. Caldwell's opponent is incumbent Democrat Salud Carbajal. He was elected in 2016 after serving three terms as Santa Barbara County Supervisor. Carbajal says his most recent term in 2018 has been especially productive given the House majority, and he hopes to continue his work next year.
And it went from being a marginalized member of Congress or party, should we say, in the House, to actually moving things forward and solutions forward.
Carbajal has introduced 39 bills as the primary sponsor during his two terms in Congress. 9 of his bills have passed through the House as parts of larger bills. For instance, Carbajal sponsored the Coastal State Climate Preparedness Act, which directed the Secretary of Commerce to establish a response program for coastal climate change. Parts of the bill ended up in the Coastal and Great Lakes Communities Enhancement Act, which passed the House. Many of Carbajal's infrastructure and transportation-related bills ended up in H.R. 2, the Moving Forward Act. The representative currently serves on the Agriculture, Armed Services, and Transportation and Infrastructure Committees. The Democratic candidate has voted against party lines just 4 times in the most recent term, according to ProPublica's vote tracking. Carbajal is, however, a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus, a bipartisan group of 50 representatives committed to finding common ground. Representative Carbajal was also recently diagnosed with COVID-19 and has been quarantining in his home since then. He says he's feeling better, but that this virus should be taken very seriously. Carbajal has raised about $1.7 million for his 2020 campaign, according to the Federal Election Commission. Caldwell has raised just under $800,000. Reporting for KCBX News, I'm Sean Flannelly.
Continuing KCBX's election coverage, we hear from Don Addis, one of the candidates vying to represent the Central Coast in the State Assembly. We'll hear from incumbent Jordan Cunningham next week. KCBX's Greta Mart started out by asking Addis how campaigning is going for her.
I appreciate the opportunity, but no, it's going really well. The early ballot returns are off the charts with Dems voting in record numbers. Both locally, I've seen Tommy Gong's figures come out, and nationwide. And then I don't know if you saw, but Vice President Biden and Senator Harris endorsed me, which was just like huge the last couple of days. So that's been exciting. And we've just had so much support over the last year, really. I've been in the race for a year, and I've just had an incredible outpouring of support here.
Okay, got it. And so how much longer is your Morro Bay City Council term?
I was elected in 2018.
So if you're elected to this, then somebody else will take your place on the city council?
Yeah, the assembly is a full-time job. One of the reasons that I'm very different from my opponent is he has a full-time job in the assembly, plus he is running his private law firm on the side, making up to $1 million a year. And showing up in court sometimes on days that he has taken, you know, personal days from the assembly. And I really plan to do it as a full-time job. I think it's important for the people of the Central Coast to have a representative who's going to be up there doing this as a full-time job, because there's a lot of urgent things.
What are going to be your main focus at, let's say, top three areas of action?
Housing is huge. You know, as we know, over the last 4 years, housing has gotten harder, not easier, on the Central Coast. Coastal protections, combating climate change, and the whole host of things that come with, you know, climate change, combating wildfires and making sure that we're fully funding for wildfire prevention. And then really top of my list, and most of the, you know, all three of these things go together, but top of my list is also COVID recovery. We've got to help our small businesses get back in business, help those that have been able to eke through back to prosperity, and help local workers get back to work.
How do you plan to help those businesses?
Well, on the council, you know, I've worked very closely with the chambers. We've awarded a couple different economic development contracts to our chamber, one before COVID, just because Morro Bay is always looking for opportunities to partner with our businesses for economic development. And so decided to work with our chamber. And then when COVID hit, we allotted another contract, knowing how hard it was going to be for our chamber to stay afloat and to work with local businesses. And then this week, we just approved mini grants that the city will be giving to businesses who qualify. And it's the second time we've looked at doing that. I think we were one of the first cities to look at doing that. And our small businesses were in the midst of trying to apply for PPP and, you know, all of those things. And now they have said they're ready and they would like us to put that kind of program in place. So you know, one of my focuses is really listening to what people on the Central Coast need. I think I'm a lot more in touch than my competitor, to be totally honest. Having that city council perspective really helps me understand and has given me unique perspective on what the people of the Central Coast need. And I've been here, you know, working in the schools, been here as a mom, been here as a community organizer. My life's work has been about finding out what people need and then helping them reach their full potential.
There was a mailer, or I think I got an email about it from Cunningham saying, you know, oh, where's Dawn Addis? She refuses to debate. What's your take on that?
Well, it's a sad and desperate attempt by Cunningham, and it's flat out untrue, which has been the tone of his campaign, you know, just to make stuff up, really. So I have said yes to four different debates that he either, you know, just wouldn't respond to or said no to. This goes back to February, actually, of this year. I said yes to Cuesta. I said yes to U40. I said yes to AAUW down in Lompoc area. And I said yes to GALA in conjunction with League of Women Voters. And all of these are nonpartisan forums where they invited us. And I immediately said yes, I would be happy to attend. And he either said no or he didn't respond. And so then I realized, you know, he really is only going to get together if it's in his safe zone. And I don't want to play those kinds of games. I want to talk to the voters about real things. And I think he's, you know, spending too much time arguing about debates instead of really proving his record, because I think he's scared. You know, he's missed over 800 votes in the assembly. He has missed over 60 days of work. And as I mentioned, some of them, they, you know, he was serving private clients in the district, making double, you know, making money from the taxpayers, plus making money from his own private business on the same day. And I think he'd rather kind of make up a bunch of fabrications than actually have a debate. And by the way, Greta, there is a standing invitation that he just hasn't replied to. He told GALA in conjunction with League of Women Voters that he couldn't come. And so they responded and said, can you give us a date? And he has not been willing to give a date. I am absolutely willing to show up, and he just won't do it. So, you know, it's just a sad, desperate attempt because of his record, I'm guessing. You know, I get the people of the Central Coast. I'm talking to people all day long. I understand the, you know, what families and kids are going through because I work with our local schools. I understand what our businesses and residents are going through because of my time on city council. Over the last 4 years, I've been shoulder to shoulder with folks across the district who are standing up to destructive policies. And it's a huge difference from my competitor who, you know, won't stand up for us. Even when Trump threatens to take wildfire money away from California, the incumbent won't speak up at all. And it's, you know, it's time for change, and people are really excited for change. I think 2020 is a real opportunity, and I am excited to start, you know, hit the ground running on day one to show up for the people of the Central Coast. It's what I've always done, and it's what I plan to do. And I'm excited. I actually, you know, like representing people. I like serving people. So I'm excited for us to have somebody in office that is going to enjoy serving constituents instead of avoid them.
That was California Assembly candidate Dawn Addis speaking with KCBX about her campaign. We'll hear from incumbent Jordan Cunningham next week. Reporter Harry Lawton of KCSB spoke to the Registrar of Voters for Santa Barbara County about a safe vote-by-mail election during a pandemic, the role of the post office, and questions regarding student votes. KCSB is the non-commercial FM radio station operated by UC Santa Barbara.
Joseph Holland is the man to talk to at election time. He's been the county registrar of voters in Santa Barbara for almost 20 years. Holland, was first elected registrar in 2002. He missed the electoral chaos of 2000, ending in the Supreme Court's decision to grant the presidency to George W. Bush. I asked him what his biggest concern was in this election.
I want folks to not wait till the last day to vote their ballot, because if there is a criticism of voting by mail, I think it's a valid criticism that if you wait until the last minute, we can't count your ballot until the days after Election Day, because we just don't have the capacity to do it. But if you get your ballot in early, we're going to process those ballots. We're actually processing ballots today. And then at 8 o'clock on election night, the results of your vote will go up on our website at 8 o'clock.
Voting early, of course, avoids another couple of problems. Number one, in the midst of a serious health crisis, mail-in voting clearly avoids possible contagion. Number two, a hastily signed ballot could lead to a mistake.
You need to sign the envelope that you return your ballot in. Mm-hmm. And you need to do it carefully. You don't want to do it hastily, because we check all those signatures against the signatures we have on file. And, you know, we have 50,000 people who've never voted by mail before. They need to responsibly sign the envelope.
Of course, the best efforts of Joe Holland and his staff could come to very little without the unquestioned cooperation of the post office.
We have the post office on speed dial, so we consider them our partners. I have complete trust. Women and men in the postal service are going to come through for us and make this all work.
With UCSB officials who know exactly who has registered for the university in the fall quarter, the Office of the Registrar does all it can to let everyone in Isla Vista know how and where to vote.
In 2008, in Isla Vista, UCSB, the turnout was over 90%. But now, with this election, because of COVID, I don't know if they all came back. So we'll just have to see. But we're prepared.
Could voting by mail result in a surge in voter fraud in Santa Barbara County? In 20 years, as Registrar of Voters, Joseph Holland can recall no more than three cases of voters trying to vote twice in the county. One example he gave was that of a mother who signed a ballot for her absent child. And this misdemeanor was caught and resulted in the guilty party receiving a stern letter from the district attorney, and there the matter rested. I also asked Joe Holland about the issue of voter suppression.
Well, you know, we just have very forgiving voting laws here in California. So, for example, we're processing the vote-by-mail ballots today. We're, you know, checking the signatures, opening the envelopes, and getting the ballots ready to count. In other states, they can't do that until election day. The whole point is to get people to participate in democracy.
In a further phone conversation with Registrar Joseph Holland, he reported that the local Republican Party in Santa Barbara had actually put in a request to put out their own ballot boxes in the area. That request was immediately rejected. Holland has had no information about any unofficial drop-off boxes appearing in Santa Barbara County, by the way. He urges all voters requiring any further information, including the location of the 30 official drop-off points in the county, to go to the county's website, sbcvote.com. So don't forget to vote, and don't wait until the last minute. You've got 2 weeks to do so. And this is Harry Lawton reporting for KCSB.
That was KCSB reporter Harry Lawton speaking with Santa Barbara County election official Joseph Holland. The U.S. Census Bureau has finished counting people for the 2020 census. But that doesn't mean it's over. Now the real work begins. Or does it? KCBX's Greta Mart spoke to two experts on what happens next and what's worrying a lot of people about this year's census. First up is Didas Kitgagi, director of California Complete Count, which coordinated the state's 2020 census outreach and communication strategy.
For every person that's missed in an area, a community, it's about $1,000 per person over the next 10 years. So absolutely, the counties have done a great job. They outpaced what they did in 2010. But in terms of representation, because these census data numbers will go into the calculations for reapportionment, It all depends on how other states do. It's a pie that is divided up, 435 seats. And so if, you know, we here in California and our counties and areas do better than, say, Texas or Florida or North Carolina, then we have a chance of not losing a seat, and they have a chance of not gaining a seat. So it's kind of a pie that's divided up. But surely we want a complete and accurate count so those dollars can come back to our communities.
So the complete count, somewhere I read you guys spent $190 million on this campaign. And I know for myself, like I filled it out, obviously, as a reporter covering this kind of stuff. I filled it out the day it came. And yet then about 4 months later, two people came to my house to tell me I hadn't filled it out. So where did that money, where did $190 million go? And the second part of the question is, why was there a lot of repeats of kind of when those people could have gone out somewhere else?
Right. I want to separate out that what we do here at the state is totally separate from the actual enumeration, which is done by the U.S. Census Bureau. So they control the actual enumeration. Unfortunately, none of us states have any control over how they run their operations. And typically, states have not gotten involved in terms of outreach. But we started here in the 2000 census, and I was part of that as well, and the 2010, because we realized that things coming out of the, you know, federal government sometimes don't translate well when they get all the way over here to the West Coast. And so that's when we decided that Californians know Californians best, and they're the ones that can really convince people to be counted. So our work here at the state is to support the efforts of the Census Bureau and their constitutional duty to get a complete and accurate count of all residents here in the United States. However, you know, California was not going to leave its fate in the hands of this administration. And so that's why we did put forth, the governor and the legislature invested about $187 million to make sure that Californians were counted. And you know what? It was a successful investment because I think about if we hadn't invest anything in terms of educating Californians, where would our self-response rate be? And would we have trusted that the U.S. Census Bureau was going to do everything that they needed to do to count all Californians? So to date, over 10.5 million California households have self-responded. And that's tremendous. That's 2 million more households than responded in 2000, and about 1.2 million more than households that responded in 2010. So our efforts were incredibly successful. 2.4 million of those households were in our hardest to count communities.
Could people respond online in 2010?
No. In fact, the 2020 census is the first time that the U.S. Census Bureau had this option. It was, and they couldn't answer on the phone either. So it was just by mail in 2000 and 2010.
Wow. I wonder if that boosted a lot of response because it made it so much easier.
It's easy for some folks, but people who have low or no broadband access, it made it harder. Many rural areas don't have access. And, you know, many, you know, poorer communities are not always online. So it surely, I think, helped, you know, in light of the pandemic and wildfires, because you didn't have to have that physical piece of paper, you know, receive it and then send it in. You could go online with your ID or without your ID to be counted. Something that I worry about in terms of once this data collection is done, the real work begins at the Census Bureau to clean up, you know, the data, to do the data quality, and there's no transparency in that. So many advocates are a little bit worried about, will the Census Bureau do what they need to do to make sure a complete and accurate count happens? And will there be transparency so that we can see in general? Again, for privacy reasons, they don't make that available. But in 72 years, you will be able to, when they release today, you know, your kids will be able to see where you were and where you were counted in 2020.
That was Didas Kitgagi, director of California's Census Office. Next, KCBX spoke with Mike Lattner, professor of political science at Cal Poly and senior fellow with the Union of Concerned Scientists Center for Science and Democracy. Greta asked Lattner if concerns are warranted that the Census Bureau, under the Trump administration, won't produce an accurate 2020 census.
The administration has attempted to glean information and to add new information, and in many ways has attempted to sabotage this census from the beginning. But in terms of what they'd like to do, there's no question. We know from the court proceedings that the intent of this administration was to first add a citizenship question to the census, which would have and probably did reduce response rates for the purposes of using that information to provide to state legislatures in the next redistricting cycle as a means of excluding Hispanic citizens and residents, and as a means of amplifying their own political power by means of reapportionment. And reapportionment is the process that we use to allocate seats to elected bodies, state legislatures, Congress, and the like. After that got shut down by the courts, and the Supreme Court of the United States did not buy the rationale that the administration was selling for putting on a citizenship question, which would have diluted the quality of the census. Every previous director of the census and acting statisticians and people that use this data, particularly those in the voting rights community, were very clear that this would actually damage the capacity for the Department of Justice to enforce voting rights by distorting data. Never since the history of the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 have we ever needed or used citizenship census data. That data is put together in other ways, in more accurate ways, where we're not asking people about whether they're legal residents or not, but we use aggregate data and survey data that is anonymous and therefore more accurate. So that was sort of part one. And then, there's been a series of events. The administration has made clear that they're going to try to use aggregate data and match it to the census data for purposes of providing citizen voting age population at a very granular level to state legislatures. Again, their sole purpose here, and we know this, again, from court proceedings, from the documents that were revealed by Thomas Hoeffler's daughter, that they were, and they experimented with drawing electoral districts in state legislatures and Congress in a number of states. And they knew that by diluting the votes of Hispanic residents and others, that they could increase the vote share for, or the seat share for the Republican Party. And that is their intent. And so we should make no mistake about this. The census is being sabotaged. It is my view that the new president-elect of the American Statistical Association is correct when he says that this is not a rigged census. It is a sabotage census.
What does this mean for us here in SLO County and on the Central Coast in terms of, did you look at the response rate that's been so far?
I've had a look at it, and it's slightly better than we've seen in some previous attempts, but there are still quite a few people that are uncounted, and there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. And my main concern is that what we're seeing happen here now that the administration hasn't gotten its way with what it's trying to use the census for and turning it into a political weapon, they're basically disregarding it. And they're dropping the amount of work that needs to go in order to get an accurate count. And what we'll see from this is not only an undercount of the exact populations that actually need more of a voice in our society, the marginalized and the underprivileged in our society that are the hardest to reach for a reason. But this is going to have a massive economic and political impact. The U.S. Census is the single largest project that the government undertakes outside of going to war. It is one of the oldest projects of the federal government. Thomas Jefferson designed the first census, and it is a crucial arguably the quantitative and scientific foundation of our democracy, to the extent that we use it for apportioning political power. Not only that, but there are the economic consequences. The census is used to distribute hundreds of millions of dollars in federal monies based on population characteristics. And then there are the economic consequences. So every market segmentation study that's done, all of the business and private sector uses of census data that are either directly or derived from census data, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars of economic revenue that's based on census data. That data will be tainted, distorted for a decade. And eventually what we'll have to do if we have a new administration is that there will need to be a supplemental census in the next few years to correct these problems.
Okay, I was going to ask that. So for people who are just appalled to hear everything you say, is there anything somebody can do? What can we do to fix this?
Well, the most important thing you can do is to be counted. But, you know, after that, I think the next important thing that we can do is to make sure that people vote and vote this year and have a voice in the political process. Because what we are seeing is a level of structural racism that that we really have not seen in this country. I've never known of the census to be used and politicized for this purpose before. And the one way that we can fix this for sure is for everyone to have a voice in this election and for democracy to function.
That was Mike Lattner, professor of political science at Cal Poly and senior fellow with the Union of Concerned Scientists Center for Science and Democracy, speaking with KCBX News. Every year, a number of whales are killed off the coast of California when they're struck by cargo vessels. One spot that's particularly dangerous is the Santa Barbara Channel. In response, researchers at UC Santa Barbara have developed a whale alert system for transiting vessels. KQED's Saul Gonzalez talks to a marine scientist about the program.
That's the sound of a humpback whale off the coast of California. In recent years, these waters, especially around Santa Barbara, have gotten more dangerous for the giant mammals because of the increased danger of collisions between whales and cargo ships. In 2019, there were 13 confirmed vessel strikes in California waters, although the real number is thought to be much higher. In response, researchers at UC Santa Barbara's Benioff Ocean Initiative have developed a first of its kind system to help ships avoid hitting whales. Marine scientist Morgan Vasali helped develop the program and explains why Santa Barbara's coastal waters are especially dangerous for the mammals.
The Santa Barbara Channel is really a biodiversity hotspot. We have really nutrient-rich waters that attract all different marine mammal species to this region. So we have important feeding grounds for endangered blue, humpback, and fin whales. We have tons of dolphins. We have the gray whale migration that goes through the channel. Also in the channel are internationally designated shipping lanes that direct 4,000 transits per year of large ships going to and from the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. So in the Santa Barbara Channel, we have a lot of shipping traffic, and we also have a lot of whales and marine mammals. And so it's a busy stretch of ocean.
So you and your colleagues have developed a system to find out where whales are in the channel and then transmit that information to ships passing through. How does it work?
So there are three main technology components of WhaleSafe. One is an acoustic listening system. So we have underwater microphones or hydrophones that are listening for sounds in the water and is able to pick up the calls of blue, humpback, and fin whales. Those are then sent back to shore via a satellite link and are verified by a scientist. The other components are a blue whale model. So it's basically like weather forecasting, but for blue whales. So we use oceanographic data like sea surface temperature to predict where blue whales are likely to be on any given day. And then there's also whale watching and tourism boats that are out in the channel nearly every day. And there are actually community scientists on those boats that then record sightings with a mobile app called Whale Alert. So we then combine the acoustic detections, the visual sightings, and the blue whale model to produce an assessment of whale activity each day in the Santa Barbara Channel.
And when you find the whales and send off their locations to passing cargo ships, you hope that the vessels slow down. So what does success look like for this program?
We'd really like to see more of the ships slowing down when we're in times of high whale activity. So because part of WhaleSafe is also tracking ship speeds, we'll be able to measure the success to see if we are seeing higher rates of cooperation with the slow speed zones. And then, of course, success is fewer dead whales washing up on our beaches or coming into port wrapped over the bow of a ship. Nobody wants to unintentionally hit and kill a whale, and so we're hoping that this data will really help empower mariners, provide them with better situational awareness so that they can take proactive measures to stop these strikes from happening.
That was UC Santa Barbara marine scientist Morgan Vasali speaking with KQED's Saul Gonzalez. Working Lunch is a weekly Facebook Live conversation put on by the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. This week, you'll hear a conversation about the local real estate market.
I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the SLO Chamber, and today you're going to be a part of my conversation with Chris Richardson, President of Richardson Properties. I'm so looking forward to our conversation about residential and commercial trends. Chris, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Jim.
You and I talked a lot as we ran into COVID. Wait a minute, what's going to happen here? How are we going to do real estate? So can you tell us what that was like, how that pandemic changed your typical day or where we are today?
You know, March, mid-March, late March, when we went, you know, all in the shelter at home, I mean, nobody knew what was happening. I mean, the stock market was in its free fall, and, you know, we just didn't know what was going to happen. So there was a 30-day period where it was just kind of, you know, shell-shocked a little bit. That being said, the focus quickly pivoted to, I don't know if I'd say an opportunity, but we had lots of discussions about connecting with your clients and people in your network and checking in on them, seeing how they're doing, seeing how they're dealing with us and what they're thinking, and conveying to them that you're here and of service in any way. We certainly weren't, you know, thinking of a real estate transaction at that point, but I think it was a huge opportunity to deepen the connection with your network and your client base and your prospect base. And that was a message that we tried to convey to our teams. And I know they embraced it and really engaged with their network. And I think that really positioned us and them well to be ready for what ultimately, you know, turned around in the real estate market, probably in, I'd say, June, July is when things started to heat up and transactions started to occur. So that was a focus that we had. And many of us are working from home. So, you know, figuring out how you can still have that connection with your teams. And, you know, we've come up with some unique things to do. And certainly we're utilizing Zoom. And I think there's a lot of silver linings that have come out of this too. Our office meetings, we have a higher attendance rate just because it's easier for people if they don't have to get dressed and come into the office, they can log in. So there's some things that I think that will continue going forward. Certainly, I think people have a thirst to have that opportunity to socialize like we did pre-COVID. So I'm looking forward to hopefully sometime soon when we can get back to that again. Outside the real estate market, the things that we're seeing, like the parklets and the downtown, and I lived for 7 years in the downtown, and so I know it well. I personally look at it, and I see a lot of positivity, a bright future. And the parklets, drive down the street now, it's like, why in the heck weren't we doing that before? The setting down there and the ambiance. So I think, you know, there's a lot of good that's going to come out of this, and some lessons learned and some opportunities. So I know there's a lot of pain out there still, and there's, you know, companies that aren't doing well, and industries that are really struggling and sectors of the economy. But I do see a lot of opportunity, and I'm optimistic.
One of the things that I and others probably thought was that this would absolutely destroy property values. You know, we'd be in the tank. It doesn't seem like that right now. Can you talk a little bit about what the residential market kind of looks like now compared to what you were seeing in January, February?
Yeah, I think we were in a good market coming into the year. And I think people in the industry were optimistic it was going to be a good year and kind of building off of 19. And it started that way. And then obviously the whole world changed. And for two or three months, it was unclear where we were headed. I mean, what we're seeing is a couple things. One is we're seeing more demand from the areas that we typically saw demand, Northern California and Southern California and the Central Valley. That's kind of the markets that we see people moving here from. And typically there's some sort of a connection to San Luis or Cal Poly. We're starting to see more people from those areas that really didn't have a connection. They're identifying it from a geographic standpoint. You know, it used to be, oh, you know, San Luis, great wine industry. Cal Poly's awesome. The downtown is great. Weather's fantastic. Beaches, hiking. But you're 3 hours from LA or 3 hours from San Francisco Bay Area. And now that but has turned into an and, because people want to be further away. So I think it's opened people's eyes to this area as a real option. And obviously that plays into what we were talking about before with the ability to work from home and that sort of stuff. That's changed things too. So we're seeing stronger demand from those places. And I think people that are here, and this is not just here, it's around the nation, because I've got, you know, broker and broker owner contacts that we're constantly checking in with around the nation and the world. And people are really taking a hard look at their home and how they're living in it. And obviously we're all spending a lot more time in our home. Does it have a place where I can work out? Does it have an outdoor space? Does it have an office where I can, you know, really focus and get work done? So I think people are taking a look at where they're living, and there's some movement that maybe wasn't considered pre-COVID. That's in a nutshell what we're seeing. And the market, it's vibrant. There's not a lot of inventory. We're probably around a month and a half or two, which is lower than people would probably term kind of healthy supply conditions. Yeah, that's what I'm seeing in the residential sector.
Besides residential, you also have commercial on your team. How is that looking?
Well, you know, commercial retail obviously is going through a tough time. Office is as well. I'd say retail is probably a little tougher. That's an unfortunate outcome of the pandemic. But I think even in that, there's opportunities. Unfortunately, if someone closes, maybe someone has a new concept. And so I think that we'll see those spaces absorb over time. I also think it's important to look at the uses in downtown and maybe zoning regulations. And, you know, the market changes, as we've just seen, and it can change very quickly. We saw it change quickly in 7 and 8, and we just saw it change quickly earlier this year in a lot of ways. And so being nimble and able to, you know, for instance, maybe some office space on second floor, maybe that could be reconceived as residential if there's not as much demand. Maybe there's some office users that would love to be in more traditional retail ground floor space. So I think there's some opportunities there to look at the way that the zoning regulations work with the city and find some creative ways, kind of like the parklets, and have a more nimble ability to flex and stretch depending on where the market's at and how things are moving. I think that's really important, because as we're seeing, things are happening fast and you got to be able to adapt to move forward.
Yeah, as we need to be flexible and nimble, which government is not always the best at, though the city of SLO has done an amazing job during this pandemic, and hopefully that muscle memory will continue on in. We're always talking about the cost of housing in SLO. If there's some quick flips where we can reuse former sites from commercial office and move them into residential and some of those other things, there's the potential to support retail by creating more housing right in those locations, right? I mean, in terms of making it better usage potentially.
Yeah. And I, you know, downtown, I mean, we have these two fantastic hotels, Hotel Cerro and Hotel SLO. So we have these two new assets in the downtown. And so I think building off of that, building off the parklets, and with the hotels, you have a resident downtown, albeit typically a transient type stay, but you have more residents downtown. And if we could have some more flexibility or have flexibility in some of the zoning and maybe look at some areas where second floor office is not, you know, the demand's weak, and maybe you could reconceive it into some studios or some loft spaces or something. And then you have a whole new product type downtown and a whole new resident downtown. And I think that keeps the downtown vibrant. Some of the housing that's come downtown is really important of all price points. I think we need housing here, and we have a fair amount of it occurring now, which is great. It's taken decades to get to this point, but we need all types of housing. We need studio rentals all the way up to high-end homes and everything in between, of course, workforce and market rate.
Yeah, one of the key pieces is having that availability at all levels. I'm Jim D'Antona. Thank you so much for being here. Chris Richardson, president of Richardson Properties.
And finally, on the nonprofit story, host Consuelo Mukes checks in to learn more about one of our local nonprofit organizations. Today, the conversation is with Doug Jensen of the Guadalupe Nipomo Dune Center.
Tell us a little bit about the location of the Dune Center and the general history of it, if you would.
So we are located in a converted Victorian home that was built in 1902 in the heart of historic downtown Guadalupe, right on Highway 1. And initially we were started by the Nature Conservancy in the early to mid 90s. The Nature Conservancy at the time was buying up parcels of privately owned dune property, and they opened a visitor center in Guadalupe in association with all of these properties they own. Uh-huh. So initially we were a visitor center, but in 1999, by then the Nature Conservancy had given away the parcels of dune area that they had purchased, and they spun off, us off as an independent nonprofit. We've been independent since 1999. We've worked with hundreds of thousands of people, but one of the things we're most proud of is the fact that we've worked with over 100,000 children. Children that live between Lompoc and San Luis Obispo go through our programs in some form or another, whether it's field trips to the dunes, in-class programs that we deliver to supplement school day learning. The thing that really drives us are free after-school programs that we deliver at places like the YMCA, or Boys and Girls Club, Club Star in San Luis, you know, ACES, such as After School Education and Safety. All of these school districts on the Central Coast have programs for kids who don't have a place to go after school, but need enrichment programming. So we deliver science education. So in normal times, annually, we work with anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000 children. Because we deliver it in the school day or in these after school programs, a lot of people are actually unaware of the extent of our reach.
Yes. And are these elementary school children or middle school or what age?
Our main constituents are third through fifth grade kids.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think a lot of people do know about that, but I did get wind that you have some special educational programs going or educational videos right now for students. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is really exciting. Earlier in the year when COVID first popped up, I knew that people were going to need entertaining things to do at home. Mm-hmm. And I also realized that because of how tumultuous the world is right now, that everybody needs a sense of levity. So in late March, it was kind of like, okay, how can we provide what the public needs and how can we support families and teachers? It all started with an idea I had, you know, one of those shower ideas. of a COVID-19 time capsule.
Oh.
And as somebody who studied history, I realized we're living through history right now. Wow. And so I thought a time capsule would provide a forum or a way for parents to talk to their kids about this scary virus. Plus, with all the toilet paper and hand sanitizer shortages that were happening at the time, I just kind of pulled it all together in this time capsule idea. As part of the federal government's COVID Relief Act, we actually received very prestigious funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities to continue delivering these online activities. So if you go onto Instagram and search for the Dune Center or even Facebook, at this point, we're probably around 125 different science activities that people can do at home using materials from their home and their kitchen. It's a way for families to learn about science and nature from the comfort and safety of their own home.
Yes. So what type of things are on this program in the time capsule?
What we've tried to do is come up with activities that will pique your interest no matter what you're interested in. There's something for everyone. Uh-huh. So it ranges from like the COVID-19 time capsule to lava lamps. We were so successful with the activities we were posting online and in social media. We created a page on our website called Dune Center at Home. And a YouTube channel that we've recently released. So we have lava lamps that you can make at home on our YouTube and social media. Some of the stuff that's been really popular has been backyard scavenger hunt. Uh-huh. So you can do a scavenger hunt looking for various bugs and plants in your backyard. Bird bingo. You print out your own bingo sheets. And it's a way to get families and children in particular outside during the interesting times that we're living in.
Well, that sounds amazing because you can get the whole family involved and then you can also keep them in touch with the Dunes Center.
Yeah, and it's all thanks to this grant from the National Endowment of the Humanities that, you know, they only awarded 10% of the grants that were applied for. Mm-hmm. And it was highly competitive because it was all humanities organizations throughout the 50 states and the U.S. territories. Right. And so when you scroll through the list of all the organizations that receive these grants, most of them are in places like L.A. or San Francisco. So for Little Guadalupe to be up there on that list, it's extremely exciting. And it's also a great opportunity for children in this more rural area to be on par and have access to activities that their more urban and affluent peers have access to.
Well, that just goes to show that the Dunes Center is not just something local, but you are something that's brought national attention to our area. And I know you have something else exciting over there, a webinar you did about the Lost City of DeMille.
Yeah, for those who were unaware, in 1923, Cecil B. DeMille filmed the first version of the Ten Commandments here in the Dunes, and it was the largest movie set ever built in history. It was one of the very first blockbuster films when movies were just taking off in popular culture. And so it's been this wonderful gift that has brought worldwide attention to Guadalupe and the Dunes Center and then this region as a whole. It's an excellent draw for tourism. We are right on Highway 1. And when we've done excavations, we've been in the media on every continent, except for Antarctica, because there's no media there. But after that happened, we're in like German film history textbooks. Our museum visitors are actually international tourists that are driving between LA and San Francisco on Highway 1 and stopping here. That's obviously not happening right now because of the pandemic.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Host Consuelo Mukes is having a conversation with Doug Jensen of the Guadalupe Nipomo Dunes Center.
And in August, we held our first webinar. We had 125 participants on Zoom and even more on Facebook Live. So if you go to the Dunes Center's Facebook page, you can actually continue to watch it. But we had people in London wake up at 2 a.m. so that they could watch the webinar on the Ten Commandments excavation. And it's really timely too, right? It's a great story, very Indiana Jones-esque, at a time when we're all kind of looking for a way to escape the negativity in the media. So.
That's amazing. And you really have put this area on the map as a result. Do you have the head of the Sphinx in the museum?
Correct. Yeah, this last excavation, we found the head of a Sphinx. It's gargantuan. It's about 300 pounds. And we got the head upright for the first time since the 20s. It was a huge experiment. It's all made out of plaster Paris, and it's been at the beach for nearly a century. Typical conservation techniques didn't work with it. And so it was a lot of experimentation as far as preservation of statuary goes. The right side of the Sphinx is still buried, and we've raised 70,000 of the 140 we need to continue the excavation. So ultimately what we're hoping to do is excavate the whole Sphinx and put the statue back together so that there is a piece of this movie set preserved. Most of the movie set is part of a 12-story tall building, and so we can't really preserve it. You'd need a 12-story tall building to house them. And so that's why we're really focusing on one of the Sphinxes, because it's the only thing that could feasibly fit indoors.
That's wonderful history right there, too. So you're talking about having it on display and all, but it seems that right now you're closed. Is that correct?
Correct. We're closed right now. We are experimenting with tours by appointment. Everything right now is a giant experiment. So if you are interested in visiting, feel free to give us a call or shoot us an email.
You have something on your website also that people might be able to take a look at called the Sand Challenge. And looking at that a little bit, I guess you help people to realize how old something is or where sand has come from.
Yeah, that's another fascinating story. I've been with the Dune Center for about a decade. And when I was hired, there was a little end table with little like jars and basically trash that people had picked up on the beach when they had traveled. They scooped up some sand and they brought it to us. Huh. And it was just here in the museum and not being, you know, much, not much was being done with it. But when I watched some of the school groups we have come in, and kids would arrive not knowing a place existed and leave wanting to visit New Mexico or Aruba. And I realized that it was a geography lesson for kids. It was also a geology lesson in that the color of sand tells you what kind of minerals are locally prevalent to that site. The size of the grain of sand tells you how old a region is. So if you are on a beach where there's lots of pebbles, it's a new beach. Whereas it's very fine sand, it's been around a long time, generally speaking, because it's been like pounded up by wind and waves. So sand is much more interesting than you would ever imagine.
Right.
When we redid all the exhibits in the Dune Center, we connected the jars of sand to Google Maps. We put QR codes on each of the jars of sand so that anybody with a phone, or you can use one of the iPads here in the museum, scan the QR code and it takes you to Google Maps and shows you exactly where the sand came from. And then there's photos that people have uploaded that actually show you, you know, images of where the sand came from. And it is an amazing teaching tool. And it's gotten to a point where it's grown. Now that we've organized the shelves by continent and we started passing out little business cards that have all the information that we need to put the sand in our collection, it's really grown to the point where we get sand in the mail constantly. After we unveiled the Sphinx head a few years ago, I actually went to Egypt and saw the original Sphinx. And I thought, how meta would it be if I collected sand from the Egyptian Sphinx and had it here in California with our Sphinx replica?
And did you get the sand?
Yeah. My tour guide scooped it up for me because I wasn't sure if there are any rules. But yeah, it's here in the Dune Center. But another really exciting thing, it's funded through the National Endowments of the Humanity Grant. We're actually photographing and scanning everything in our collection, and we're going to make it available to the public. If I have my way, it will actually be next week that it'll go live through the website. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of fascinating scientific reports in the dunes, as well as, you know, different historical material. One of the folks who helped preserve the dunes so that they're available to the public was an early female environmentalist named Kathleen Goddard Jones. And when she passed away in 2001, she gave us all of her rare plant specimens, all of her library books, and a lot of reports. We have some of her correspondence from the 20s when she was younger. All of this is going to be made available online to anyone who wants to research the dunes, environmental history. Kathleen Goddard Jones was doing environmental work in the 50s and 60s. She's very much a groundbreaking figure that not a lot of people know about.
I know that you are a 501c3 nonprofit. So you do have a membership. So just tell us really quickly about your membership and if people can still become a member, and also any other way the public might be able to help support this wonderful historical center in our area.
Yeah, the public support is more important now than ever. All the work that we're doing to support families and teachers right now, even though the museum's closed, we're still working really hard. We're still open online. And so if folks would like to support that, they can go to dunecenter.org/donate. Or if they'd like to contribute to our efforts to get all of this educational material online, we're trying to figure out how to do that with volunteers working remotely. So they can certainly contact if they'd like to volunteer their time as well.
That's excellent.
Yeah, it's dunecenter.org. There's an S in there. So it's D-U-N-E-S-C-E-N-T-E-R.org.
Doug, thank you so much. Well, this has been the Nonprofit Story with Doug Jensen, the Executive Director of the Dune Center. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.